Some people, including our speaker, feel that this is the era of arms control. Others, since we have a treaty now, feel that the whole problem has been solved. And there are fads and fashions in international relations, and they say that the problem is put behind us. Fortunately, we have people like Dr. Paula Scalingi working hard on the whole issue of arms control, including her subject today, which is treaty ratification. She will, in addition to commenting on that, also answer questions and discuss the current START negotiations. She's been going back and forth to Geneva, and so is very much in touch with that. Paula Scalingi was born in Ann Arbor. She received her bachelor's degree from the University of Miami, where she was Phi Beta Kappa. She received her MA and PhD summa cum laude from Florida State, and also an MA in journalism from American University. She was also a graduate of the Foreign Service Institute in Washington. She taught at Mary Washington College and at Florida State and Tallahassee Community College, and has continued to publish all through her period with the intelligence agency, and recently gave a paper at the professional meetings, I believe, on SALT II and treaty ratification. So she will tell you a few more deep, dark secrets which about her career, which I wouldn't dare to discuss, but which are part of the subject.
Well, I will be letting my hair down just a little bit in our meeting. May I ask, are any members of the press present? No, that this is good. Because one of the things I'm going to zero in on today is treaty ratification, because the executive branch is looking toward ratifying the Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty and the Conventional Forces Agreement. And in light of what happened to START II, which of course was never ratified, people tend to be worried about that. But before I begin on that particular topic, I would like to say a few words about the future of arms control. Now, the 1990s is going to be the era of arms control, because we are going to have on the books, hopefully if they are ratified by late next year, Conventional Forces Reductions Agreement, the START Treaty. We have the two protocols for the nuclear testing agreements that are in the process of nearly being ratified by the Senate. We have underway now negotiations on chemical weapons, and you can bet there's going to be a big push for that. You can also bet that the administration is going to try to figure out what we can do in the area more, in the area of nonproliferation. But a real problem there with what's happening in the Middle East. Defense and space, which at the moment is really going nowhere. I have a feeling this is a personal view, particularly if you end up with a second Bush administration, that like with Reagan, the fact that he is unfettered, that we will probably be very innovative when it comes to an agreement on weapons in space, but that's a personal view. Now, keeping in mind all these agreements, not only that, you have the implementation of these agreements, and that has already changed to a great extent the way that we do business in terms of monitoring. The intelligence community has to monitor the treaties. We have an on-site inspection agency, OSIA, which was set up to handle the INF inspections, and its responsibility personnel is going to vastly increase. You have industries that are involved in arms control verification, a fair amount of money being pumped into that despite the state of the economy. And you have an interaction among nations that you just did not have before, because look at us with the Soviets. We have Soviet inspection teams coming over. We go over there. Things have changed to such an extent in the last 2.5 years because of INF, but I think it's not apparent to people. So arms control isn't going away. It's become, as I like to say, an integral part of foreign policy. It's been institutionalized. Okay, so much for that. Now I can get off my soapbox with arms control. What I have been focusing on is ratification, because if you don't ratify the agreements, they're really worth nothing. For the INF Treaty, at the time I was working for the Arms Control Intelligence Staff at CIA, and what ACIS does is it attends the interagency meetings that formulate arms control policy, sitting in for the Director of Central Intelligence. So in my capacity on ACIS, I represented him at the working group meetings. So we were involved in negotiating the treaty, we were involved in supporting it, and in ratification. Because when it comes to ratification, what the intelligence community has to do is prove to Congress that it can monitor the treaty. By law, it must monitor the compliance with arms control treaties. And I have some handouts that I'll be sending around. There's an article, which is the only one of its kind, which I managed to get through the agency's publication review process, which explains about the agency's role in arms control. It's very useful, particularly if you know people who teach classes on arms control. In any event, on INF, for INF, it was not very well done by the executive branch. In fact, you can say that the treaty got ratified in spite of the effort. As people say now, I mean, you look back, of course the INF treaty was going to be ratified. If you look at the times, Gorbachev was in control in the Soviet Union. We had detente was underway. The treaty itself banned two different categories of missiles, intermediate range and shorter range, encompassing 9 different missile systems. There was no way that it could not be approved. And yet the executive branch was disorganized. You see, what we do in the executive branch is there are a number of agencies that are all involved in making arms control policy, and I'll get into that in a minute. They run by committee system. So what basically we did is we just continued for ratification to do business as we always did. There was a proliferation of different committees. There was one major committee. It had a subcommittee. Max Kampelman headed the overall committee. He was the head of the nuclear and space, or the INF negotiations. The chief negotiator for INF, Ambassador Glitman, was on Capitol Hill. He had his own little group, and they were doing talking points and questions and answers for the senators. Then each of the executive branch agencies were answering questions for senators through their own apparatus. And what happened, we were, inconsistencies were cropping up, to say the least. So I decided that I was going to, before we got around to starting CFE ratification, interview all the people that I knew who had taken part in INF ratification and those that I could find who had been part of the abortive SALT II ratification endeavor, and to see, well, what did we do wrong, and how could we make things easier? I'm used to this, by the way. Back home, we always have work going on.
We never know when it's going to hit.
Well, that's all right. In fact, just yesterday at a committee meeting, we finally did tell them to quit. But this is okay.
You have more power than we do.
In any event, the most fascinating aspect of these discussions with these people is that each would say, for example, if you talk to somebody from the State Department, they'd say, well, look, yes, we really were disorganized in INF, but if the State Department just had charge of the situation, it would have been all right. And if you talk to somebody from the Arms Control and Disarmament Agency, he said, what do you mean, State Department? I mean, they know nothing about the process. If ACTA simply had charge, then it would have been well orchestrated. It was just amazing. So the bottom line here is that you have to ignore what people in the individual agencies say, get everyone's input, and then come up with an overall scheme. And that's basically what I did. To do this, I focused on the executive branch agencies. There is the intelligence community, the Office of Secretary of Defense, Joint Chiefs of Staff that represents the military services, the State Department by virtue of its overall foreign policy responsibilities, Arms Control and Disarmament Agency, because it is the only agency specifically tasked to do arms control, and then the Department of Energy, because it is tasked with overseeing U.S. nuclear weapons programs. We also have two what I call minor players, second string. The on-site inspection agency that I just mentioned to you set up to handle the INF inspections, and the Nuclear Risk Reduction Center. That was established before the INF treaty, and that handles all the notifications that come from the Soviets. So they have a vested interest in how the inspection regime for START and CFE is set up. So you have these agencies. Now, they're supposed to be managed by the NSC staff, but if you have a weak NSC staff, you have problems. We have a pretty good NSC staff at the moment. It just really depends on the people and the president. These agencies are competitive. They don't cooperate for a long period of time, and ratification of START and CFE are probably going to take, well, CFE will be a lot easier. START may take as much as 9 months. INF was 6 months. It really depends on the Senate and how well the executive branch functions. Okay, so how can you make this process easier with these competitive agencies? Well, the second element that needs to be kept in mind is what I call political necessities. These are things like the timing for ratification. Now, the U.S. position at the moment is finish these treaties by the end of the year. That's great. You have people on the Hill who say, do not dump two treaties on us. We cannot cope, because they're wound up with the budget problems and a whole host of other issues that they have scheduled in committee hearings. I hope somebody is listening to them. That's how things stand at the moment. We are attempting to complete them by the end of the year. Another thing to keep in mind in terms of timing is the political problems of different key senators. There may be reasons that they don't want to address the treaties at a particular time. Another element that needs to be kept in mind, this is a political necessity, is executive branch consensus. If you have dissent within the executive branch, you've got a problem. This happened in SALT II, where you had Brzezinski and Vance operating at cross purposes. Another political necessity is your public relations campaign. You have to prepare the American people before you go ahead and have the signing summit, and all of a sudden the treaty comes into the public domain, because your interest groups are going to rush forward with their interpretations. And speaking of interest groups, you have to be able to know which interest groups are going to be against the treaty, which are for the treaty, and which are straddling the fence, because oftentimes interest groups, for example, in Washington we have the Heritage Foundation and CSIS and various influential think tanks. Nobody has the treaty except the executive branch. They're getting this coal. This thing is around 500 pages long. It's enormously complex. Every conceivable loophole people have tried to plug. And in doing so, some of it looks incomprehensible, but it really isn't, as it is with all, you know, legal documents. So there needs to be good briefings set up for interest groups, for industry, who is going to be affected by the inspections. Another political necessity, and this is extremely important when you think of SALT II, and that's that the administration needs to be able to monitor what is happening as far as international developments and domestic political developments which might affect ratification. With SALT II, you had the purported Soviet brigade in Cuba, the invasion of Afghanistan. The administration should have understood that that would have had an impact, the Carter administration. Domestically, you had a consensus, growing consensus in the United States that we needed to have a stronger defense. And you also had a strong sentiment on Capitol Hill that felt that SALT II was a treaty which was not acceptable. So the administration needs to be able to monitor these developments. Well, that brings us next to what I call the substantive inputs that the executive branch has to be prepared to put into the ratification process. And this is crucial, because the people on the Hill, when you talk to them, say, well, we're expecting the complete negotiating record. And if you talk to some of the executive branch officials, they say, well, we know that we provided this for INF to the Senate because they insisted in the wake of the flap over the interpretation of the ABM treaty. But look, it doesn't mean that we have to give it to them for START or for CFE. Wait a minute. Time out, they want it, and they are going to expect it. So we have to give them 8 years' worth of START, and I figure they deserve what they get. That's one of the inputs. Another input is a breakdown, provision by provision, of what each provision means. Now, by law, ACTA, the agency that I am with, has to provide that. But we have to do a good job of it, because this is basically going to be, as far as the Senate is concerned, what the treaty means. Another input, and there are real problems with this one. The military services are going to have to be prepared to go before the Senate committees and explain the military sufficiency of the various provisions. In other words, okay, if we agree to a cut of ballistic missile warheads of so much, is this going to negatively impact U.S. military operations? What about the verification provisions? Are we covered if we have to display to the Soviets our reentry vehicles, which happens to be one of the verification provisions in the treaty? I mean, is this going to divulge any security information? So the Joint Chiefs of Staff has to be prepared to do this, but basically the services tend to disagree among themselves. And as far as I know, nobody has prepared to do this. But if you talk to some Senate staffers, they're expecting this. It's a problem. Another input, and this is a key one, the monitorability of the treaty. The intelligence community has to go and testify before the Intelligence Committee and say, yes, we can adequately monitor CFE reductions and START reductions. And to do that, they have to produce a lot of studies, and a lot of these are classified at high levels, so they either have to lower the classification, they have to some way make accessible to people who have the clearances this information to present a convincing case. Another input, and this one certainly can't be overestimated, the costs versus the benefits of verification. START, some people say that there's verification overkill, but believe me, it's just incredible. It's hard to know what else one can do in terms of verification. There are roughly a dozen inspections and a couple of exhibitions. Like INF, there's a baseline inspection where you go and you check each facility to see what missiles and launchers are there. There are suspect site inspections. There are inspections of new facilities, inspections of closed out facilities. There is a provision for setting up a perimeter portal monitoring system at production facilities. Considering the number of facilities that are going to be involved, you're going to have inspection teams going back and forth on a regular basis. And there are some industries who are very concerned and are telling the U.S. government, well, we have to have millions to set up security systems to protect against the Soviets collecting information. It's very difficult to put for the government to put together an analysis of costs because so many of them are buried in agencies. Who foots the bill for the inspection teams? Agencies tend to point at each other. You know, the military services say, well, we're not going to pay for all this. And ACTA says, well, look, you know, we have this tiny budget. We can't pay for much of this. So the costs of verification are going to be quite high. Okay, so that's substantive inputs. Now, it doesn't matter whether your timing is right, your public relations efforts superb, you've got everybody on board, you have all your substantive inputs, and you don't have an apparatus which can manage the process. You've got to have that. So basically what I did was I came up with five different models that can be used for organizing, for the executive branch to organize its ratification campaign. The first one I titled the committee system because that's basically what we use for most everything. It's the way agencies do business. They have representatives that meet in interagency committees. When there's a new task, they set up an ad hoc committee. Basically, for a minor agreement, this can work okay. The verification protocols for the nuclear testing treaties are withstanding this system, with some difficulties right at the moment, but they'll weather the process, and I'm pretty sure they'll be ratified with no problem. For a major complex treaty, you can have real problems with this approach. So that's one approach, the committee model. The second model, I call it the dominant agency model. One agency takes charge. Let's say, as it would wish to do so, the State Department. Again, for a minor agreement, this could work, but for a major agreement, you know the other executive branch agencies will not stand for it. So it won't work for a complex agreement. A third model is what I call the ambassador model. Chief negotiators would love to run the whole show. The only problem is that the executive branch agencies view the chief negotiator as an outsider. After all, they've been sending this guy instructions for, in some cases, years, and he has done Washington's bidding. And they're not going to turn around and basically accept direction from the chief negotiator, even though, and it's true, he knows the treaty inside and outside. Again, for a minor agreement, you could do this approach, not for a major complex one, in my view. The fourth model is what I call the ratification czar model. And we had a little bit of this for SALT II. That's when the president will choose an outsider, someone perhaps from a previous administration, bring him in thinking that, well, this person is above the fray. He has national stature, and therefore he won't be tainted by all the conflicts among the agencies on different treaty provisions. I don't recommend this for any agreement, because basically the agencies will undercut him, and the hill will go directly to the agencies because they know that's where the institutional knowledge is. Lastly, there is the model that I do recommend for complex agreements. I call it the national security model. But its utility is premised on the fact that you have a strong NSC staff. You've got to have that. How this would be set up is that the president would appoint a special deputy who would be in charge of managing ratification, not controlling it, managing the process. There would be a single NSC-chaired, what I call, clearinghouse committee, that all the executive branch agencies would have representatives in this committee. And it would handle everything that goes to the Hill, everything that goes to the media, would go through this one screening committee. The only other group I would set up would be a very small, you could call it a task force, which would be charged with monitoring your domestic and your international developments to make sure that nothing was going to adversely affect the treaty, or at least would be prepared for it. The chief negotiator's role in such a system as this, well, he could have an office on the Hill, like Glickman did in INF, but he would take his direction from the NSC, and this clearinghouse committee would prepare all his testimony and answers to congressmen and senators. This is basically, I think, the best bet. And there are some people in the administration who agree with this in theory, and there are some people who will just do business like usual. It's very hard once a bureaucracy has done something one way to change it. But, it's a sort of a step in the right direction. So in essence, those are my recommendations, and I would appreciate getting your views. And also any questions that you do have on START itself. I have some handouts which probably most of you have not seen. There is a side-by-side, as we call it, U.S. and Soviet positions on START and defense and space negotiations. There is the text of the agreed points on START that came out of the summit in June, the presidential summit. And then there is a statement on follow-on negotiations, and I will pass those around.
Okay, wonderful. We have a nuclear submarine commander. We have head of the Institute of Public Service. We have two nuclear specialists here and Arms Control Institute people. So we've got people who ought to have good questions, and then we have all the rest of us who shoot from wherever we are. But who'd like to ask the first, Henry Thielmark?
As one that knows nothing about it, I'll start. Assuming that there is no really substantive problem with the treaty, that if all of the questions could be laid out on the table, is there any substantial opposition?
Well, the problem with arms control treaties is so oftentimes what it's in the eye of the beholder. As one congressional staffer who has a lot of stature on the Hill said to me, you know, there are 535 different opinions on Capitol Hill of what constitutes a good arms control agreement. I thought it was a wonderful quote, put it in my paper. And he's right, and most of these people don't know much, but boy, they have opinions. Now, there is a group of people, I don't know what some of them have been saying recently, the Richard Pearl, what I call NHTSA type of line, which is saying that START is obsolete, it doesn't go far enough, we're in a new era, the cuts aren't deep enough. Then there is another group which overlaps with that one, which says that, well, the START treaty is okay, but look, you misled us. It's not 50% cut. It's really more like an overall 30% cut. And then there's another group that says, well, why are we having this treaty anyway? We don't need it because both sides, we're now in this era of peace and goodwill, are unilaterally disarming. I love that group. When it comes to the first group, which is the START doesn't go deep enough. As I said to one Senate staffer, whose senator about 6 months ago wanted to go for a complete MIRV ban in START 1. MIRVs, these are missiles with more than one warhead. The problem with this is that we have spent 8 years getting to where we've gotten now. The treaty is horrendously complex. Take START as being START 1. It is the first step. The administration is committed, as are the Soviets, to follow on negotiations and also committed to reducing multiple independently targeted warheads. So don't expect that everything to be thrown into this treaty. Wait till you see it. There's more than enough in it. It's a great foundation to build on. For the second group that says, well, the cuts are only 30 to 35%, you've been misleading us. Well, actually, that's not the case. For a cut in, the cut in heavy missiles is 50%. The cut in throw weight is going to be cut in half. For ballistic missiles, indeed, you are going to have deep reductions. So in terms of accounting rules for air-launched cruise missiles, if you look at the overall number of warheads, because we have a counting rule for air-launched cruise missiles that so many per bomber, indeed the number of warheads overall is going to be more than what a flat 50% cut would be. But again, it's START 1, and it is a start, a good start. The last group, unilateral disarmament. I love that. The problem is it can be reversed, and there's no verification. And I, for one, would not want to take another country's word for it that they were going to cut their nuclear arms. Also, we have, the Chinese have nuclear weapons, French and British do. There are other nations who are going to be getting this capability in the future. I don't know what we're going to do about that yet. I'm trying to think of something. But unilateral disarmament, in my view, certainly is not the way to go.
I've got a variation of Henry's question. The impact of these interest groups to a great degree is structured by sort of the climate, the psychology of the time.
You're right.
When the INF agreement was being campaigned for, we were in the early stages of this rapprochement with the Soviet Union. Now we have a different climate. We're cooperating in the Security Council. My question's a simple one. Do you think, because of the psychology of the climate of the times, you may have a better environment? And these interest groups' political velocity, so to speak, may be reduced quite a bit.
Well, I do agree with you totally. It's a different environment. And on the plus side, the opponents of arms control, the real, you know, knee-jerk conservative Richard Perle types, Edelman types, it's hard to support their philosophy when you're in a, you know, such an era of detente as we are. But then, on the other hand, I wish these people would recognize that the Soviet Union still has all these massive, this massive nuclear capability targeted exactly where it's been targeted for the last several years. So that's a problem. You know, even after START, both sides will have a tremendous strategic nuclear capability. It needs to be cut further.
Follow-up of that. Have the changes in the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe brought in any new intelligence information that would have an influence on our agreements?
Well, the information flow is prodigious, of course, and I can't say what intelligence we're getting, but I can certainly say that one of the things people are keeping in mind in the executive branch is that the Soviet Union is certainly under siege. And what happens in a situation where you have strategic nuclear weapons based in different parts of the Soviet Union? I mean, what is going to happen then? If you do have disintegration partial, or, well, there's always a possibility of total. So it's certainly it's a major concern, but we have now in Europe a whole new ball game, and it's very hard for people to judge where it's going to go. I don't think anyone in this room, no matter what information they had, could get a feel for where we're going to be another 3 to 5 years from now. I mean, look at the Middle East. It's
Yeah, just to follow up that question, you know, you talked about the U.S. ratification process, and I think it's one of the interesting things now is that we really have to worry about the Soviet ratification process.
Oh, you're so right, and I should have said something, and you are correct. And what that's certain Soviet negotiators, when I was in Geneva, and this has happened to other colleagues of mine, the Soviets will say, look, we have our Supreme Soviet to worry about. We have to get, it's at least a majority of them to agree to this treaty. And so it does not behoove the United States to try to convince its Senate by saying, well, isn't this a wonderful treaty for us? Because it puts us at a great advantage to the Soviets. Because it's not going to play very well over in Kiev, for example. The other element of that, I'm so glad you brought that up, because I missed that. I mean, I just went right over that, is that it's going to be different for ratification, especially for CFE, because you're going to have negotiators and high-level officials from the different arms control participants going around and testifying in front of the legislatures in the different countries. So the Soviets are going to come here, and I bet Aspen will have Soviet generals and Soviet negotiators testifying. I mean, there's a precedent for that. We have had that sort of testimony in the last year and a half or so on the Hill.
Next question.
Yeah, it's a good one.
Mr. Cooper.
The invasion of by Iraqi of Kuwait has had a substantial effect on the thinking of the administration. Is that being reflected in our disarmament objectives?
Well, the government tends to focus on one crisis at a time, and it normally doesn't look down the road. People talk about it, but it's hard to marshal your resources to focus on non-proliferation and technology transfer. And there is some of that now, which is underway, but so much of the emphasis is on crisis management at the moment, that it's hard for people to get a handle on, you know, the picture down the road. So,
Bill Wemple.
Isn't there a serious question whether the liberation of these treaties was a good idea? When we just had the U.S. and the Soviet Union, really the only two that counted, they could deal with each other and make deals. Now we see that the Soviet Union seems to be falling apart, and a number of other countries, including, of course, Iraq, are becoming pretty major powers. If we don't have everybody signed up to a treaty, it could have some very serious holes in it. If, on the other hand, we try to make it a United Nations venture and have the United Nations be an administrative body, that would pose very obvious, serious political difficulties and objectionable features for us, let alone some others. So I'm questioning, I guess, and I don't have any alternative, but I'm questioning the whole underpinnings of a proliferation of these treaties at the present time.
Well, I would certainly argue that to say that they'll have holes in them, that you don't try to control armaments at all. You're quite right in that in no way are they, I mean, for example, if you take the non-proliferation agreement, there are certain key countries which have not signed on. There are some countries who don't do a very good job of holding up their side of the bargain. If you can have, though, and START and CFE, well, INF was the first step in this direction. If you can get agreement on verification provisions that will literally allow the participants to go and police each other, that goes very far to mitigating some of the concerns that you have. But you have to make a stab at it. You have to lay a groundwork for us just to wring our hands and say, well, look, you know, we just can't get a foolproof scenario here, therefore don't try. Just think of how far we have gone with INF.
How can you protect yourself against the non-signing?
Well, I think the key is to have a military capability which takes into account the treaties. In other words, military sufficiency, again. You don't let your guard down, but you can reduce and maintain strategic stability, which has been two administrations' policy. It's hard to do, but it's not impossible. That's what we're trying to do.
Next question. Yes, Reed Johnson.
You mentioned early on the problem of proliferation of nuclear weapons capability. We've read recently, very briefly, that the conference that was being held towards the 1995 renegotiation of the non-proliferation treaty broke up over the question of this country's continuance or insistence on continuing nuclear tests. You want to, it would seem to me that the non-proliferation treaty is one of the, given things that are going on in the rest of the world, is one of the most important treaties in this area that we now have. How much emphasis is being put on seeing that it is renegotiated and perhaps strengthened in the 1995?
Well, a lot of emphasis is being placed on it. The problem with a ban on nuclear testing, the administration is committed to going on a step-by-step approach in this direction. However, for other countries to say within so many years all testing must cease, that is not realistic in today's environment where you do have countries with nuclear weapons, and particularly there are some countries that have not signed on to that agreement, so that one would be foolish simply to say, well, that's it, no more nuclear testing, we're going to let our nuclear systems basically go untested, which is not a good approach.
As long as we are not, pardon me, follow that. As long as we are no longer in an arms race with a sophisticated opponent who is continuing to upgrade their nuclear weapons capability and sophistication, what is the need for continuing test program? Is there anything that lets us think that a nuclear weapon that was built today is going to be any different 10 years from now, absent the treaty of decay problem?
Well, one of the reasons for the testing is to test the reliability of what you have. And
what we've done,
I know, I understand what you're saying. I think, in a perfect world, I'd love to see that. But I like to tell people who would go really far, really fast, look at how far we've come in the last 10 years. We're on a roll. We just need to keep going and try to feel our way along to do this in a comprehensive way, and as opposed to piecemeal. So I would say, just bear with the administration and the one that follows it, but things are going in that direction.
Other questions? Howard Cromwell.
Am I right in thinking that since both countries, Russia and the United States, probably enjoy what we call an overkill supply, that this would be persuasive with some of the people like Richard Pearl, that in order to reduce the number that's proposed, we still have adequate protection?
Well, I would, I agree with you that we can certainly go farther than what we have gone. There's no question of that. But for the Soviets and for the United States, we both have to do it in an equitable way so that it won't be a one-sided thing. So I agree with you, there's overkill. There's going to be overkill after start one. No problem. We are committed to follow-on negotiations. We just have to figure out what we're going to be doing. But we're thinking about that already.
Cuba, our only democratic little ally in the Middle East, Israel, with 100 to 200 nuclear devices, weapons tested with the South Africans, I trust, to some extent. Nobody talks much about that, but they are the loose cannon.
It's difficult in this country. I ran into a person at a conference in California a year ago, and she was from Israel, and she was up in arms about that very thing. And I said, well, you can talk about it. You know, write an editorial, an op-ed piece for the Los Angeles Times. But it's very difficult for politicians or executive branch officials to... It's a very delicate problem. As you well know.
Poor Buchanan.
Yes.
Yes, it's difficult. It's a political football in this country. That's just one of those things.
Yeah,
and
it's life and death.
But as I say, you know, it's one must tread carefully around things like that.
Other questions? Bill Horton?
Somewhat subjective, but in your following the negotiations, the personalities of our negotiators, the qualifications, of the credentials, it seems as though we have the same people as the experts, whether they're in negotiating or whether they're out, we have the same experts always making pronouncements on what's going on. What is your sort of what is your sort of observation of our experts?
Arms control has become so complex that it involves people, hopefully they have an institutional knowledge. And you do actually want people who have specialized in that for years. And these people need to come from all different parts of the U.S. government. For example, in intelligence, you have people who understand weapons technology and understand monitoring for compliance. And in ACTA, you have people who are a lot of nuclear physicists and other scientists. Again, you have to understand how the systems work. You have to be able to deal with a very arcane subject so that you're right, maybe more than other areas. Arms control tends to foster what I call an arms control fraternity. And there are some people here who may consider themselves members of the arms control fraternity. That's why anyone can break into the area, but you really do have to have a good foundation in it. And once you do, you're part of the fraternity, and you're right. People just circulate around inside and outside government, think tanks and different agencies. But there's nothing wrong with that, really. New blood is coming in all the time. I gather you don't share that point of view.
Well, I question it from time to time.
For instance, on this subject, has Richard Burt brought himself up to speed pretty quickly?
He is a very bright individual. And he, of course, had a good grounding from his educational background, and he was... of course, instrumental in INF, and basically if you have a grounding in INF negotiations, going from that to strategic arms reductions, which a number of us did, is, you know, no problem. The only thing you have to catch up on is what we call the air-breathing side of the military forces, which is your heavy bombers and your air-launched cruise missiles, and he is more than up to speed. Yeah, he is riding high. Very bright guy.
Is ACTA where it ought to be in the structure of the American government?
ACTA is an equal player with the other agencies. It depends on personalities. When Richard Perle was at OSD, OSD had a great deal of influence. Well, it still has a great deal of influence, but Richard Perle isn't there anymore. ACTA is, I would say, an equal player with the others. It simply needs more resources. It has 250 people. And the other agencies have, in some cases, you know, thousands. So
it shouldn't be inside the State Department.
Well, I have mixed feelings on that. The plus is when I have to deliver stuff to state people, which is on a daily basis, we back and forth, I don't have to send it to another building. I can walk down the hall. I don't know if that will help or not, being separate and out of there. I have to think about that one some more.
Howard,
I'd like to ask one more question. You in your different models, I thought, indicated to me that you thought the National Security Council offered a great opportunity. But isn't it dominated by the administration's appointees that would shake the confidence of maybe some senators who hold radical different points of view?
Well, no, because the NSC staff is recruited from the agencies. Those people who have the most expertise and a great deal of stature are seconded to the NSC staff. Then there are some political appointees at the highest level, but the working level people, they come from the military services, from CIA, from the State Department, occasionally from ACTA. And these are the people who sort of do the nuts and bolts work. So actually in the Reagan administration and now in the Bush administration, the NSC staff has done a very good job of staying out of the interagency deliberations unless there's an impasse. And when there's an impasse, then they will go ahead and play Solomon. And basically decide to cut the baby in half or who wins, who gets the baby. Yeah. My quibble with the NSC staff and these two administrations is perhaps they have been too deferential to the agencies and are afraid of press leaks, and which some agencies will resort to whenever the decision doesn't go in their direction.
Term ready.
I have a nuts and bolts question. A few months ago, we had an expert from the OSIA, the On-Site Inspection Agency, come down.
Yeah, who was it?
Can't remember his name. He is the historian for the OSIA, and he got his doctorate, I think,
The history of an agency that's 2.5 years old. That's so wonderful.
There is one on-site now at the On-Site Inspection Agency. He walked us through the nature of the kind of inspection arrangements that are being set up under the INF, and I was utterly amazed at how pervasive it is.
Isn't it something?
And then without getting too much into it, he said, in effect, you've seen nothing yet.
He's right. You have seen nothing yet. It is mind-boggling.
Well, my pedestrian question is, do we in the Soviets have enough technical expertise to undertake the pervasive level of verification that's
well,
going to be required?
Well, that is a bit of a problem, and some of the agencies complain that they won't have enough manpower. But basically, we have this INF pool of people, and that will just be expanded somewhat. My feeling is that we have to get into the start in the CFE inspections, and I think then the full force of what resources we need is going to hit home. And I think it's going to be a bit of a shock. That's a personal view. Other people will disagree with me.
So it's going to be a shock. We should be encouraging our graduate students to look at this.
I would say definitely. It would be very useful. I think OSIA is a great place. The military services, the agency, CIA, It's a good place to go and work to prepare yourself for this line of endeavor.
You're going to be recruiting in my class, so if any of you want to guess, since the media isn't here, are they?
Thank you.
Would you care to make any comparisons between the Reagan and the Bush administration in terms of capacity in this area? Or do you want to take the Fifth Amendment?
I think the end of the Reagan administration and the Bush administration so far has been really amazingly consistent in the fact that it's the commitment to arms control, to moving forward on that. They've also been consistent in that when it comes to defense and space, SDI, that sort of thing, that things are roughly the same for both administrations. I'm going to be interested in seeing if indeed, I don't know if Bush will get reelected or not, how things will fare in the last, you know, the last 4 years. And I have a feeling that if he had his druthers, he would even push forward at a faster pace. But again, that's just my personal view.
Richard Neustadt used to say that the hope both of the government and of universities was to have some in and outers, people who were in government and then went back to academia and were in academia and got tapped for government service. If this happens, why it's going to be because people like Paula Scalingi have kept up their academic credentials with writings and footnotes and all the pedestrian requirements for academia, but at the same time have made a real contribution to public policy. So we're very grateful that she'd take time to come.
Well, I'm glad that you invited me. I thoroughly enjoyed this.